Hello, this is Courtney Act. I am at the National Gallery of Victoria here in Melbourne because I am going to see Queer Stories from the NGV Collection exhibition.
Excuse me, can you tell me which way to the Queer exhibition?
You can take the elevator up to level 3.
Thank you. Hello, welcome back to the NGV's Queer Podcast. I'm Courtney Act. To begin, I want to acknowledge the Wurundjeri Woi Wurrung people as the traditional owners of the land on which this exhibition and this podcast takes place. I pay my respects to their elders, past and present, and to Aboriginal elders of other communities who may be listening. We're going a little bit in depth and having some great conversations with some of the curators here at the NGV and also some of the artists whose work is on display at the NGV's new free exhibition titled Queer from the 10th of March through until the 21st of August 2022. The exhibition explores the NGV collection through a queer lens, and it's pretty massive. It includes over 400 works by artists who identify as queer, some of whom who lived at a time when such identification wasn't possible, and works by artists who are not queer, but with a connection to queer histories. It's actually one of the most comprehensive thematic presentations of artworks relating to queer history that's ever been presented in an Australian art institution. So I'm really excited. I hope that you're able to get in to the NGV to see it for yourself, because there's so much to take in and so much to enjoy. Today we're talking queer sensibilities. That's our theme, and I'm going to be talking to Linda Jackson AO. She has been a pioneering figure in fashion design since the early 1970s when she formed a creative partnership with designer Jenny Key. She's known for her bold silhouettes and prints drawn from the Australian landscape, her spirituality, as well as rich collaborations with other artists. Also in this episode, I'm going to be chatting with Angela Hessen, curator of Australian art. We talked about this theme of queer sensibilities. And now I'm joined by the curator of Australian art, Angela Hessen, and we are going to be talking about queer sensibilities. Welcome, Angela.
Thank you so much, Courtney. I'm thrilled to be here.
Now, queer sensibilities, I guess the title queer in some people's minds might raise questions about, you know, its historic context being used as a word of oppression for the queer community. And then also when we're looking back at First Nations communities or we're looking at ancient communities where that language didn't exist, people might have questions about how this terminology is applied. But in this conversation, we're talking about the sensibility of queer, so something perhaps beyond gender and sexuality. Tell me what queer sensibilities means.
Well, it's a very complicated question. and I think that's really the perfect way to contextualize it in terms of the difficulties attached to that word in its various kind of historical usages. Because in terms of sensibility, queerness, I think, is still linked to gender and sexuality. But it is also, I think, about something more elusive. And when we think about those historical contexts and a lot of ways that queerness was defined by forces that were hostile to it throughout history, it's often been about kind of trying to pin down that identity, to attach an idea of a queer identity to facts and acts and something that could be criminalized, legislated against, and understood in a way kind of boxed in. And I think what's so exciting about talking about queer sensibilities is that this is really about the kind of really defiant and inventive, imaginative rejection of that kind of idea. So in many cases, this is related to ideas of transgressions around ideas of a gender binary or fixed ideas of sexuality and desire. But it's also about the problematization or the inversion of all other kinds of hierarchies that define social positioning. So even the ways we think about taste or class, for example, ideas about what's high or low art, queering is really about playing with all of those different categories and hierarchies and often undermining them in some really funny and subversive and often beautiful ways.
I've read some ideas about, you know, queer and queer theory. And like you said, people's desperation to try and categorize and label and name. And I guess in a way, queer is the antithesis of that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, queerness is, you know, I think inherently about fluidity, and it's about challenging those kinds of parameters. And of course, you know, parameters have moved all through history. You know, the parameters that were normalized through much of the 20th century weren't those of the ancient world. They were different to those of the 18th and 19th centuries. But the idea of queerness really is, I think, celebrating a freedom from those kind of social and cultural parameters. And there's also a real kind of aesthetic freedom in that too. So even the idea of embracing decoration, ornament, you know, these are aesthetic categories that historically have often been marginalized or feminized. You know, the decorative in art is less serious than something that relates to content or form, you know. And I think this idea that surface can really mean something, that surface and excess and ornament can carry some quite subversive messages, is a really kind of powerful one too.
And well, I guess some of these, I've got some pictures of some of the pieces that sort of typify queer sensibilities in this queer exhibition at the National Gallery of Victoria in front of me. The first one here is the Worcester?
Oh, Worcester. Worcester? One of those really annoying English words.
I can say Worcestershire sauce, and I have a friend who lives in Worcester.
There you go. That's the word. That's what you're
okay,
after.
This is the word. In fact, I just put some Worcester sauce in my meatless rissoles that I made last night.
Oh, it sounds delicious.
It was actually. Put some kimchi on it, melted a bit of cheese. It was delicious. This Worcester Royal Porcelain Co. I'm looking at a teapot, and look, just to look at, the teapot looks a little camp.
It is a little bit camp. It's really, I think, if you're wanting to give somebody a lesson in camp, this teapot's a great starting point. It's one of my favourite objects in the show.
And teapots at the best of times are a little bit camp anyway.
I think so. And I think with this one too, I mean, there's something so incredible about the fact of applying all of that extraordinary personality to a functional object. And, you know, and such a kind of domestic object too, you know, the teapot, it speaks of all of these kind of very polite rituals, you know.
Yeah.
So I think there's something really kitschy and amazing about it.
I'm going to try and describe this teapot that I see. I profess to not be the most knowledgeable when it comes to period fashion, but I can see that it's from 1882. There's two teapots, in fact. One, look, I don't want to be binary here, but I would say that one is more masculine in so much as it contains facial hair, a moustache. One is more feminine, and that there's a hand on the hip, and then it's the I'm a little teapot dance that we're familiar with from the nursery rhyme. There's a hand on the hip and the other hand is the spout, and the hand is sort of like, what do you call this action?
I think the homophobic terminology is limp wrist, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. That's well, the... I don't know. I embrace my limp wrists. there's a limp wrist as the spout. And then there's a sort of not a ruffle collar. You might be able to help me better with the description of the collar, like a cravat.
Oh, it is really a ruff, I think. Yeah. Oh,
okay. There you go. We've got some long sort of auburn hair, a very delicate porcelain face with a little bit of a lip and a little light blush on the cheek, and then some sort of hat on the head. Maybe it's not quite a beret, but sort of like a baggy hat, perhaps?
It's certainly quite jaunty, jaunty little hat. And I mean, the thing that's actually the key point about this is that actually what you're looking at there is front and back of the same teapot.
Ah, and plot twist.
So that's the plot twist. And that's the thing that really kind of makes this such an interesting object, because it's literally this idea, and for all that we kind of, you know, don't really want to ascribe a binary, the maker of this was intending a binary, I think, to some degree, while also undermining it. But the idea is that you have, you know, two genders sharing this one porcelain body. And all of those kind of characteristics that you identified of being quite effete in both figures, the kind of the dainty pose and the decorative nature of the costume, all of these are really relevant to this period of 1882. What that object's actually linked to is a really particular history, and there's an inscription on the base of it which really makes all of this really clear. And then the inscription on the base says, "Fearful consequences through the laws of natural selection of living up to one's teapot," which is a little bit of a mouthful and a little bit confusing without the sort of surrounding history. But it's actually referring to one of Oscar Wilde's best known aphorisms, which dates to his years at Oxford in the late 1870s, when he became really well known as a collector and dandy as well as an intellectual. And he had a famous collection of blue china, blue and white china, that he loved. And he's quoted as having said, "I find it harder and harder each day to live up to my blue china." So the idea that, you know, of your collection as embodying this idea of aesthetic perfection that you can never really attain as a, you know, as a brute human, you know. So, and of course, it's said in a completely reflexive, you know, self-parodying way that so many of Wilde's comments are framed. So that's part of that quote. The fearful consequences through the laws of natural selection, this is referring to exactly what you'd think. So this is coming in the wake of Darwin's Origin of Species and all of the controversies that surrounded that. There's a lot of misappropriation of Darwin's theories in the years around the 1870s, 80s, 90s. And this is precisely because conservative commentators are really anxious about the broader social transformations that they see taking place towards the end of the 19th century. They're very anxious about the challenge to religion that Darwin's theories constituted, so that's part of it. But another really big focus for conservative commentators at this point is the idea that gender and sexuality might be something other than fixed and immutable. And figures like the dandy, who we see as the male half of this teapot, are really the embodiment of that threat. This is the idea that, you know, that men could be interested in taste and fashion and the finer things in life. The idea that they might reject that kind of more military Victorian masculinity that's been celebrated for so much of the century. This is a really kind of dangerous idea for a lot of conservatives around this time. And so it's one that's parodied everywhere, including in objects like this one.
And perhaps even a dangerous idea for conservatives around this time. Again, it's so interesting. I think something that comes up through these conversations with the curators is that the more things change, the more things stay the same. And I mean, this may have been 1882, so I guess 140 years ago. But it's interesting that, you know, we sort of feel like we might find ourselves in a similar place in 2022.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think this feels like a very relevant object to me. I also think what's really interesting about it is that the joke in it isn't necessarily where you might immediately think it is. To me, this isn't really about satirizing dandies and aesthetes, for all that it kind of looks like a caricature of a dandy. To me, that inscription on the bottom, it's such a kind of ridiculous and hilarious premise that in attempting to live up to an aesthetic ideal, you risk becoming a teapot. You know, it's like, you know, it's inherently ridiculous. And to me, that then makes the kind of conservatism that underscores an idea like that ridiculous too. I mean, maybe that's my bias coming into play and the fact that I also really like the object.
No, I mean, I would have just looked at this and gone, oh yeah, there's a camp looking teapot. But then through your insights and hearing more about it, there's this huge, rich and wonderful world. It's time and history, the context of that era, the inscription on the bottom, you know, all of those cultural relevancies. It's so interesting to dive deeper into these things.
It is. And I think, you know, the other thing that I think is really interesting too, though, is when you say your first impression of that would have been, that's a camp-looking teapot. That's just as legitimate in a way, you know. And I think that's one of the really beautiful things about camp is that camp is, you know, it operates as a language in a way, doesn't it? You know, it's very hard to actually define what makes a camp object other than that we know it when we see it, you know. And there is this kind of incredible combination of often a kind of a potentially a serious message with this wonderfully playful surface that defines camp. And there's a wonderful quote from Susan Sontag. She says that camp is above all a mode of enjoyment, not judgment. It's generous. It wants to enjoy, you know. And to me, that just sums it up so beautifully. You know, it's something that is available on so many levels. It's kind of a great object and a great launching point into all kinds of, you know, bigger discussions.
It is. The next item I'm looking at is by Peter Behrens. It's called The Kiss, or Der Kuss in another language. I'm going to go potentially German. Tell me about this piece.
So you're right. Peter Behrens is German, and he's actually best known as an architect. But this is probably the most well-known of his prints. I think it's an absolutely gorgeous image. It's one of the better known ones in the exhibition. I think what's really interesting when you look at this, what it is it's two faces kissing, as the title would suggest. And they are surrounded by this wonderful kind of fantastic entwining web of hair. It's almost like they're trapped in this fairy tale briar wood of hair. What I think is really interesting about this, Courtney, when you look at those two faces, do you ascribe gender to them? What do you see when you see that image?
I see two people kissing. They really could be any gender. I guess the only thing that perhaps feminizes is the length of the hair, but that's obviously also, you know. For some reason, it's bringing up images of an album cover, like from the 70s. Did somebody use this imagery at all?
Look, I don't know if this exact image was used, but you're spot on with the 70s, because Art Nouveau, which this is a wonderful example of Art Nouveau design. Art Nouveau had a huge renaissance in the 70s. And so even if it wasn't this image, you will certainly have seen something like it on a 70s album cover. And I think that kind of key point, though, about the identity of the two faces is to me what makes this such a kind of fascinating and beautiful image, is I think everybody sees this image differently. I think we all project to some extent our idea of beauty or our desires or whatever onto this image. It was widely read as being an image of a lesbian kiss for quite a long time, I think because of the length of the hair, but I don't know that was necessarily the intention of the artist. And what I think is so interesting about it, again, in a similar way, I guess, to the teapot, is that this is very much embedded in that moment right around the turn of the century, when there is an enormous openness to the idea of possibility and transformation. And we've got, of course, the suffrage movement is kind of in full swing around this period. There's the first real discussion about sexual identity in the wake of Oscar Wilde's trials and imprisonment. And there's also a real interest in spiritualism and the supernatural around this time. There's the sense that material moment of the turn of the century symbolizes something much bigger. And so all of that kind of fantastic possibility, I think, is encompassed in this kind of image. There's not any kind of correct reading of it, but to me it's just wonderfully queer in that very broad sense.
So from 1898, we're rolling forward into the 1900s with a piece by Ethel Walker, and it's titled Lilith, and it's an oil on canvas.
It is, and it's a lovely big oil on canvas. She's really monumental. Lilith's a really fantastic figure from the kind of pre-Old Testament. Lilith's actually Adam's first wife. And
scandal.
I know, who knew? But and more than that, it gets even more intriguing. So Lilith is cast out of Eden for refusing to lie beneath Adam. And following that, she becomes associated very much in the Christian tradition with witchcraft. She consorts with the devil. She's associated with vampires and demons. I think she gives birth to demons often.
I see goats depicted here in the image. Is that in any way referential to the devil?
Well, it's an interesting question. You see, I think what's happening here, and this is an image by Ethel Walker, who is a really interesting Scottish lesbian artist from the early 20th century. And what happens in this moment of kind of early feminist art, I guess, in the early 20th century, and literature as well, and music even, is that we see this figure of Lilith being appropriated in a completely different way. She becomes, she's refunctioned as a figure of feminine independence and power and mysticism.
She's the star of the show, because you can see in the background a sort of shadow of Adam perhaps sitting under the tree, but Lilith is the real hero of this story.
Absolutely. And, you know, and I think, you know, when you identified there's the goat in there, but there's all kinds of other animals in there. Mm. And I think what's really beautiful here is that this is Lilith actually completely at one with nature and the environment. So this isn't Lilith cast out of Eden as kind of unnatural rejecter of men. This is Lilith as a kind of pantheistic, you know, pagan goddess. And this is actually also really relevant because Ethel Walker is very interested in alternative spirituality. She's very interested in ideas of natural femininity. So this is the period also when women are starting to reject corsets. Walker doesn't want any of her models to wear makeup. She's interested in an idea of femininity that's connected to the power of the natural world. And I think this is interesting too, because it speaks again to that intersectionality of queerness, that there's a really strong association actually from the 19th century between the early stages of the women's movement and also environmental movements, animal rights movements, you know, and I'm really interested in this because they're all causes that are very close to, to my own heart. And, you know, and I think this image actually really exemplifies that. It's taking back this, you know, the devil of the Old Testament and making her into something powerful and beautiful and invested in nature. You know,
Lilith refused to lie down under Adam. Is Lilith a bit of a lesbian icon for that reason as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's certainly why Walker was interested in her. And she's, you know, she's beloved by a lot of other queer women from that period too. Virginia Woolf's right into Lilith, and Ethel Walker actually paints Virginia Woolf naked as Lilith. This isn't that image, but there is another one. So yeah, absolutely. It's, that association is certainly made at the time.
Oh, I love that. Next, we're throttled into the 2000s with an outfit by Romance Was Born, the Sydney Fashion House.
That's right. And that's the granny knit outfit. It's a fantastic thing in the true sense of the word.
It's a full outfit on a mannequin from head to toe. You've got a combination of, I guess as the name would suggest, knitting. You've got this image of granny. But the other thing that is really fascinating is all of the accessories are adorned in shells. So there's this sort of slipper that's just encrusted with seashells, beautiful seashells. A bum bag or a fanny pack, depending on where you hail from. A gorgeous necklace. And then the hat is covered in shells, and then it looks like a beard that could be crochet or it could be coral.
I love the idea of a detachable beard. You know, I think it's the most fantastic outfit. And I think that thing that you mentioned, the idea of the slight incongruity of the granny motif and then all of the under the sea business. This comes from a collection that was looking, that had a very specific under the sea motif to it. But the granny connection is the idea of the grandmother's pearls of wisdom. And then there are all of the oysters and pearls and shells. So there's the link between the two. But I mean, Romance Was Born are also really interested in the idea of traditional craft, which often has a kind of kitsch association. And we're coming back here again, you know, full circle back to camp, you know. And the idea of kind of elevating those kitsch and, you know, I think not that long ago, profoundly daggy kind of media like knitting and crochet into the realm of high fashion with this kind of wonderful irony and humour and warmth. You know, it's such a fantastic object.
It is. And speaking of knitting, I feel like that can bring us up to the subject of today's conversation with artist Linda Jackson.
Yeah, it certainly can. And actually, one of the reasons that that we thought it would be great to talk about Romance Was Born is that Romance Was Born's site, Linda Jackson and Jenny Key, is absolutely formative influences for them on their practice. So, you know, this is, I think, a really wonderful segue into talking about Linda's work. And I think Linda is someone who has really illustrated all of the wonderful ways in which fantasy and imagination can convey very kind of very diverse, very generous meanings. And her fashion is kind of, it's inherently so imaginative and so subjective, and it rejects so many of the parameters that govern traditional fashion as well. But, you know, I think there is a wonderful queerness to that, which is more kind of elusive than just thinking about binaries or sexuality.
Well, Linda's fashion, you know, famously has incorporated Australian icons, be it flora or fauna or architecture, which wasn't being done at the time, I understand. And also, Australia has long suffered from this sort of cultural cringe. And the way Linda embraced those images feels like it queers that cultural cringe and celebrates it in such a beautiful way. And one thing that I really got from my conversation with Linda that you're about to all hear is, A, the amazing artist collective of Linda Jackson, Jenny Key, Peter Tully, David McDermott, and their meeting in the late 60s and the strength of those friendships all the way through to today and the way that they all collaborated together to create art through this time. And then the other thing that was a real standout of this conversation was getting to feel Linda's appreciation and joy for Australia and Australiana and everything from First Nations art traditions to our flora and fauna and architecture. And I don't know, as someone who has lived overseas for the last sort of 12 years and part of my identity is about being an Australian who doesn't live here and grappling with that idea of the cultural cringe, there was something about this conversation that was like balm. Like, it was just like a nice warm hug listening to Linda talk about the beauty and wonder of the country that we live in.
Absolutely. There's such a sense of kind of warmth and love in her design. And it's interesting. I mean, I actually have a similar response because I've lived in Australia for quite a long time, but I didn't grow up here. Yeah. And I have that funny, you know, that sense of kind of being divided between places as well. And also there is a really interesting thing that when you study art history, I think it's getting better now, but in the past there was such a Eurocentrism to it, you know, mm-hmm. And also the sense that kind of Australian art movements are, you know, following the European, but, you know, 20 years later and often in a slightly less bold way, you know, and mm-hmm. I think this is something that is really changing now with Australian mm-hmm. art and design. And, you know, and I think also the other thing that I love, and you mentioned this in Linda's work, is that incredible connection to nature. And in a way that almost touches back on, you know, we were looking at with Ethel Walker and that idea of a kind of pantheism and a connection between art and nature, that there's not necessarily a binary of kind of nature, culture, artifice versus this kind of the natural as something that's, you know, antithetical to art. Yeah, I think it's such a kind of beautiful holistic approach to art and yeah. design. I also just want to wear all of them.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, I can't wait for everybody to listen to this conversation that I had with Linda Jackson, a lovely conversation. And I just want to say thank you so much for joining me and sharing all of your knowledge with me today, Angela. It's been an absolute joy to talk about queer sensibilities with you.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you, Courtney. And I just, I really hope you enjoyed the exhibition.
Oh, I can't wait. Well, this is the weird thing about podcasts, right, is that, like, we're recording this now in the past and I've already spoken to Linda, so I'm able to talk about her, but I haven't seen the exhibition yet. But by the time people listen to this, the exhibition will have been
out. We'll be on, so in fact, maybe we should redo that.
No, this is the wonderful thing about podcasts. Yes. We're queering the timeline. And we're queering people's perception of time through this very act of being self-referential. So I think it's perfect, in fact.
It's perfectly queer.
Exactly. Thank you so much, Angela. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Courtney. It's been an absolute pleasure.